Hello once again, everybody. Thank you for joining me here on this Thursday, August 9th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour and 10, hour and 15 minutes or so as we go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me for another new edition of the show here. Today we'll have Brad Powers from BradPowersSports.com, a name that everybody knows and loves here from Bang the Book Radio. We'll chat some NFL preseason with him and then transition over to the college side. We'll talk about the tweaks that he's made to his power ratings, his thoughts on home field advantage, and then we'll take a deep dive into the SEC. We're going to try to make sure that we've got every conference covered here in the lead up to the season. Of course, we'll do that across a number of different guests. We'll get some different thoughts on same conferences from all the guests that we have. So I want to make sure that we've got you fully prepared for the upcoming college football season. You know, when it comes to the NFL, 32 teams, you know a lot of the personnel, you know a lot of the players. When it comes to college football, 130 teams, a lot more conferences and divisions, a lot more things to try and keep up with. So we will focus a lot on covering all the college football conferences, but of course we will be doing NFL stuff here as well. As you know, this and every edition of Bang the Book Radio presented by our friends over at DSI Sportsbook. If you sign up using that promo code BANG100, you'll get 100% deposit match bonus for the sportsbook. Their redesigned sportsbook looks fantastic over there. They've been doing a lot of good things with that website. And of course, you want to make sure that you can shop around for the best lines, for the best prices here for futures, division futures, Heisman props, all those types of things. Season win totals, of course, still available out there. And then obviously, on a week-by-week basis, you want to make sure that you're getting the best number that you possibly can. I'll talk more about what we've got going on over at bangthebook.com later on in today's show, because I'm going to wrap things up with the bettors box with the time that's left on today's program. We'll go ahead and bring on today's one and only guest. It's the great Brad Powers from BradPowersSports.com. Brad, how's it going today, man?
It's going well. Good to hear your voice. I know football's right around the corner as we start up these weekly spots. Always enjoy these and look forward to a great 2018 football season.
Yeah, looking forward to a great 2018 football season as well. And before we go any further here, maybe we've got some new listeners to the show. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are holdovers from last year or maybe from several years ago when we first started doing these things. You've had some pretty good football seasons here of late, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, just, you know, if you just look at my newsletter where every pick's archived, I mean, over the last 3 years combined, in all NFL and college picks, 55%, which is pretty much what you'd want to do if you study this year round and specialize in a particular sport. And while I like to lean on the college side of things more often than not, my NFL picks have been better. In fact, just out of my newsletter, which I release each and every week, NFL picks, every single pick I've had in the newsletter last 3 years, 59%, which is, I'll tell you, if I'd have known that, I would have had the mortgage on my house every week on my NFL picks over the last 3 years.
Well, it's good, man. I hope that you keep that up. And, you know, one of the things that we've talked about, and I'm sure we'll talk about this as we go more throughout the season here, you know, obviously a lot of our listeners well established with where they are in their respective locations, but you opted to make that move out to Vegas, I believe prior to last season, or maybe it was even two seasons ago now. I don't know. Time just seems to really fly here when we're having a lot of fun, but you know, I think that you feel like that transition moving from Ohio out there to Las Vegas was something that was really beneficial for you. So do you feel like you can kind of keep that momentum going here this year? Or do you think that, you know, now you're established, you already know what's going on, and, you know, it's just going to be business as usual?
I think it's probably more business as usual. I mean, and believe it or not, this would be my third football season already in Vegas. I would say year one, there was an adjustment period, not necessarily to Vegas, but just the time difference. I think that's probably been the biggest adjustment for me since I'm an early morning person. It's a little different out here. I felt like I maybe lost that advantage. Waking up 5 a.m. in the morning, East Coast time, is a little different than 5 a.m. here, where it's already 8 o'clock on the East Coast, and we live in an East Coast society as far as, you know, the start times of these games. So that was probably the biggest adjustment. But as I enter year three, it's more business as usual. And I guess the main reason why I moved out here is just my own personal betting. I mean, I wanted to get down on a lot of this early off-season betting when it comes to college football, because I think it's probably the softest market when it comes to football. So that's probably one of the main reasons. And, you know, it doesn't hurt that it's always sunny out here in Vegas compared to, you know, the sun disappearing for months at a time back there in Northeast Ohio.
Yeah, I mean, the sun's kind of out right now, but, you know, we're not that far away from snow, and I'm sure that you really miss snow. I need you to come back here and visit, you know, sometime in the middle of winter so that we can go out and you can remember what it's like to be around this area. But, you know, one of the things that I want to drive home here on today's show, and, you know, this is something that we've driven home a lot during your segments, is that one of the things that was a transition for you going out there to Las Vegas was becoming more of a better, because handicapping is one thing, breaking down games, you know, looking at the matchups, studying your power ratings, all that type of thing. That's all part of the handicapping process. But when you go out to Vegas and you're, you know, getting in front of market moves, you're there with people that have similar thoughts as you, you know, there's a betting side to it that really is, I think, the biggest part of the learning curve here for our listeners on the show. Some are obviously going to be complete novices and maybe are just getting into this because of widespread legalization. Others maybe have a little bit more of a handle on this. Then some of our listeners, of course, probably have a pretty good handle on the betting side of things. But I know that's something that, you know, you've really worked hard at, and I imagine it will only help you going forward.
Yeah, I mean, there's really some significant differences between handicapping and betting. I mean, a lot of betting is just getting right numbers. And a lot of times, you know, if you want to be scalping numbers, I mean, you'll have, you know, two different positions on a game on different sides. And the reality is if you're handicapping and releasing picks, you can't be doing, you know, giving out both sides to a game. I mean, you can if people perfectly understand it, but obviously you got to, you know, publish records and all that. So, yeah, some big differences there. And maybe it's a little bit of double dipping on my part. I'll fully admit I'm greedy. You know, I don't mind doing the handicapping side. And I guess the difference between me and maybe some of the other guys out here is, you know, I have my own newsletter to myself. You know, I have nothing to hide. I try to release as much information as I can. I post all my betting tickets for the most part, particularly in the off season. And pretty much have my thought process on a basis level. If you just get my newsletter on every single college and NFL game, write it up every week. So I try to pull the, you know, a little bit, take a peek behind the curtain on a weekly basis when it comes to football.
All right, well, speaking of a weekly basis when it comes to football, we finally have a bunch of games to look at here. We had the Hall of Fame game last week, but as I was talking about on yesterday's show, or maybe it was Tuesday's show, I don't really consider that the start of the preseason. That's kind of more of a novelty game than anything else with that quote-unquote week zero game. So now you've got week one of the NFL preseason, and obviously for astute listeners that are looking at the odds screens out there, all of these numbers basically minus three or lower. You've got three with some extra juice on the Baltimore game against the Rams here tonight. You had Washington and New England open higher, but that one has since come down. So, Brad, kind of walk us through, you know, what you believe to be the thought process of the odds makers here in the preseason, just slapping one, one and a half, two, two and a half, maybe up to three on these week one games.
Yeah, I mean, that really hasn't changed too much over the last 20 years. I mean, basically home team more often than not. Now, it's got no doubt about it. Everyone's gotten a little bit sharper with advanced technology and just more information being out there. But more often than not, home team's going to be laying three, and you're going to have a total right around 35. The difference between the regular season and preseason betting, I know a lot of people say NFL preseason, that's for degenerates. Well, I kind of take exception to that. No, it's more for the sharp bettors. And talking with a sportsbook director here, I mean, the difference between the NFL regular season and preseason is pretty stark in comparison to the overall handle. You know, in the regular season, sharp money, professional money, probably represents 20% of a handle on a particular NFL game. Preseason, completely different. In fact, it's flipped. About 80% of the handle is wise guy money and sharp money, professional money in a preseason game. So if you see some of these bigger moves, it's not the public moving it. More often than not, it's bigger money. So I mean, let's face it, the bookmakers, they're handicapping a bunch of sports. I mean, let's be honest, there's going to be more, you know, probably more interest in the regular season baseball, or is there? Because the Hall of Fame game actually, I believe in a lot of books, even outdid the Boston Yankees game last Thursday night. So I guess maybe they'll have to adjust a little bit more, but they got a lot more worries on their plate, whether it be week one of the NFL season where there's going to be a much higher handle, week one college football rapidly approaching, different sports out there. Some books have been opening up NBA odds. They're a little bit distracted. So generally speaking, they're pretty much going to open up the home team three, total 35, and let the Sharps do with what they may. The difference being Sharps can't get down 10 G's on a game in preseason. They got to spread it around. A lot of times limits are nickels and dimes here in Vegas, and you got to spread your money around through multiple books.
Well, I'm glad that you bring up that point because, you know, when we talk about so much sharp money influencing the market, we're still not seeing that many line moves of significance. We're certainly not crossing a whole lot of key numbers here at this time of the year for the NFL. Yeah, we had the Jets on Friday night go up from -1 to -3.5. That's a pretty significant move crossing through that number of three. But as, you know, Ralph Michaels and Brian Blessing mentioned on yesterday's show, you know, we don't see those key numbers really come into play a whole lot, because these teams are not interested at all whatsoever in playing overtime in the preseason. So key numbers do change a little bit in this exhibition period of the year. But, you know, we're seeing the Browns from +3 to -1 out on the road against the Giants. And, you know, it's very interesting to look at these numbers and kind of see where they're going, try to understand the mindset of why they're moving the way that they are. So, Brad, when you start looking at the NFL preseason card, you know, what is your starting point? I mean, are you going to see what the coaches are saying? Are you looking at 2017 and 2018 draft classes to see who's going to play in these late game situations? What is it that you focus on?
Yeah, I think it's probably a combination of all the above, and I'm not going to be, you know, breaking ground here. It's pretty much handicapping 101 what's been taught for me from guys that have been in the industry, including Ralph Michaels for many decades. I mean, you start with what the coaches say. I mean, there's more information out there as far as what the rotations will be, particularly at the quarterback spot. Looking at quarterback depth charts, I mean, you can find some significant advantages with guys, you know, second and third stringers. I mean, Cleveland, you mentioned the Browns. I mean, Drew Stanton is a really good third string quarterback, in my opinion. So an advantage there might be one of the reasons why Cleveland has some money coming in on them. You know, in addition to Mayfield, the number one overall pick, and Tyrod Taylor, that's a pretty strong quarterback rotation for the Browns. So that'd be one. You know, also looking at the coaches, do they value the preseason or not? Jason Garrett could care less about the preseason. Mike Tomlin, who started off his career very strong in the preseason, has pretty much hasn't cared. Last year they had a winning record, but prior to that, I believe had four straight losing seasons in the preseason. Meanwhile, guys like Pete Carroll, John Harbaugh, I mean, they just want to win football games, and they, you know, they're winning and covering about two-thirds of the time when it comes to the preseason because they value it. So, you know, does the coach really care about it? What's the quarterback spot? And then you also got to look at situational handicapping, particularly when he gets to weeks two and three. I mean, sometimes you got teams with significant rest advantage, you know, a couple days since they really, you know, stagger these games Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. That's something to look. And also teams are really at a disadvantage flying, you know, three time zones. This is where that really, you know, takes, I would say, major notice, particularly week two, whether they're flying east to west or west to east. That's something I like to, generally speaking, play against.
Well, and of course, I mean, that's important here. As you look at what's going on with some of these lines for week one, that line move in the Baltimore and Rams game, for example, Baltimore has already played a game. They played in the Hall of Fame game last week, so they got to work some of the kinks out. B, the Rams are traveling cross-country for this game. C, John Harbaugh cares about the preseason. So not a big surprise to see a line move like that where, you know, you could also make a case from the Rams side and say, you know, they've got a young coaching staff. They've got a relatively young core of players there. They're trying to set an identity, trying to set an example. So maybe that's why this line hasn't gone up to somewhere like four, although it's certainly a possibility now with -3, -25 out there in the market. But again, you have to look for these situations where, as you mentioned, you get the total package of bad travel, coach that cares, you know, something like that. Because think about it, in weeks two and three, you know, if you're a starter and you're on East Coast time and you wind up going to play in Denver or Seattle or something like that, you know, you may not even see the field. You may not give a max effort. You may not care that much because it is just the preseason, and traveling 3 hours west or 3 hours east, you know, what does it mean to you now? You know, these games aren't, they don't mean anything. They don't count for the standings really. So they're all of these different types of things. I mean, this isn't one of those things where you have to dig deep into the depth chart and see, you know, who the third string linebackers are for the Buffalo Bills, something like that. It is a more basic handicap, but again, you still have to pay attention to everything that's going on.
No question about it. And I think, you know, how do you come up with a play in the preseason I think you broke it down pretty good as far as Baltimore. Now, I'm not saying particularly lay the full three, but, man, obviously anything less than three, the market pretty much spoke for itself. I mean, you just had ABC. And really, you know, what constitutes a play for me, a lot of times, if you got two or three check marks that are in your corner, then more often than not, I have a bet or a play release on that particular thing. And, yeah, I mean, if you really dive into the, you know, third string linebacker core, I'll be honest, I'm not going that in depth there. I just got other things. I got 130 college teams I can take advantage of. I mean, maybe we'll get into it, but, you know, for example, Iowa suspended a couple more players yesterday. You know, I'm more concerned about that getting down against Iowa on a week one game than I would be diving in the third string, you know, defensive, you know, the secondary for the New York Giants tonight. You can dive into that, and if you can, then I'll tip the cap to you. But I think more often than not, you can be successful if you're just paying attention to travel, quarterback rotations, motivation, and whatnot. And I'm not saying you're always going to have a winning season, but I would say over the long haul, over the course of three, four, five seasons, you'll win more than you lose as far as the NFL preseason goes.
Let me ask you one more thing about the preseason here, Brad, because we've got several first-year coaches here. You got Matt Patricia in Detroit. They're taking an open this week, so long travel for them. Frank Reich in the Indianapolis Colts, long travel for him, going up to Seattle to take on the Hawks. And as we mentioned already, Pete Carroll, a guy 22-10 straight up in the preseason, so he seems to care. But that line moving against Seattle there, is that one inching down towards a pick'em, Indianapolis, anywhere from +1 to +2 in the market with varying juice. So with these first-year head coaches, Brad, you know, how do you evaluate them? I mean, does it matter to you if it's a home game or a road game? You know, do you feel like maybe they want to impress the home fans, drum up some ticket sales, all that kind of thing? Do they just want to establish a culture? How do you approach these, you know, these rookie head coaches that are doing this for the first time around?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I think that's one of the more intriguing preseason trends is evaluating first-year head coaches. Generally speaking, I think people are going to think, hey, they want to play well. They want to get off to a good start. But, you know, recent results, it's been pretty much a net neutral. I mean, looking into it, you know, let's talk about the last 4 years. In 2014, 12-12 straight up and against the spread. 2015, 11-13 against the spread. And I'm talking about first-year head coaches, how they do in the preseason. 2016, 13-15 against the number. Last year, 12-9-3, three pushes there, market getting pretty tight. But, you know, generally speaking, it's about a 50-50 proposition. I think you taking it to the next level, that's where you maybe start to find some value. If you got a first-year coach that loses week one preseason, maybe coming at home, maybe their opponent already has a win, I would think that would be maybe an optimal time to play on a first-year coach needing a win, you know, starting off the season 0-1. You know, week three is more dress rehearsal, so that's going to be the week in the preseason that's going to most reflect how you'd handicap a regular season game. But what I really like is week two, betting on those teams that are motivated. They're already 0-1 against maybe a team that's sitting fat and happy, already off a win in the preseason. That's what I like to take advantage of, particularly if it is a first-year coach.
I guess one question that would be, if you're out head coaches in the NFL preseason, does the coach tree matter to you? If they come from a program, let's say a Baltimore assistant gets hired somewhere, something like that, and you've got John Harbaugh, who set these standards in the preseason. They've won 9 straight preseason games, 29 overall Harbaugh. If you get a coach that comes from do you think that's something that carries over and then similarly care as much about the preseason? Do you think that the new head coach adopts that same philosophy?
Oh, that's something that I don't know if I'm going to have a concrete answer on. That's something I don't know if anyone would particularly know until we actually get some data points. But I think, you know, generally speaking, you would think if one of their mentors really cares about it, you know, I would say, you know, maybe it's 52% chance that that guy would maybe care about it. I think it would be more of a positive EV that they would, but I don't have any data on that in the coaching tree. You know, that's something that I'll take a look at this week and see if that is indeed the case. But I'll be honest with you, more often than not, there's just specific outliers when it comes to preseason. I mean, you got guys like Mike Zimmer, and again, we already mentioned Harbaugh and Pete Carroll that really care, and then guys that don't like Jason Garrett. But outside of that, I mean, more often than not, when you're diving through these preseason records, and in my latest newsletter, which is free to download, I have everyone's records as far as preseason, coach by coach, all 32. And more often than not, it's pretty much close to 50% straight up and against the spread outside of maybe five or six big-time outliers.
All right, before we transition away from the NFL, I guess let's go ahead and throw this out there for our listeners. You know, we haven't really had the opportunity to throw out any free picks here on the show. And again, like I said, it's not something that we do all the time here. You know, maybe we'll throw one out at the end of each segment. But I really like to talk about the methodology and the philosophy of both betting and handicapping here on the show, and kind of give you, you meaning the listeners, the direction to start to figure these things out for yourselves, to see the market the way that our experts see the market. So, Brad, is there a play that you do like here for week one of the preseason?
Yeah, I like game number 253. I'm going to take the Bears with their game under their belt. They impressed me last week. I mean, he was mentioning that Harbaugh's 9-0 in the preseason the last two-plus years. And, you know, the Bears were a two-point conversion, play away from beating the Ravens last week. I think they have a superior quarterback rotation this one, game under their belt. The line's moving. Right now you can find the Bears plus one, but I wouldn't be a bit surprised that this one closes pick 'em, if not Chicago minus one. So I jump on. If you're going to go to work now. Game 253, take the Bears tonight plus the one.
And I'm just going to keep coming up with follow-up questions, apparently. At some point, I promise, we're going to get to college football. When it comes to the preseason, do you take the points or do you just play the money line with a dog?
Oh, that's a good call. And I would think even with the favorites, a lot of times, I would say, because you're always dealing with three and whatnot, I would say a money line with the dog. And right now I'd go to town on the Bears. Obviously, we're talking of a spread under three. I would go with them on the money line there. And generally speaking, a lot of times I think the money line on the favorites more often than not, because, I mean, let's look at a Hall of Fame game. Ravens were laying anywhere from, depending on what line, you got 1.5 up to three. In that one, they win the game by one. So a lot of times three doesn't come into play, but a lot of times your ones and twos do, and it's just better to take the money line a lot of times.
All right, now we'll transition over to the college football side. And I know Brad's probably chomping at the bit to do this. I know that you've done very well in the NFL, but I know college is where you really do dedicate a lot of your time and a lot of your resources looking for those opportunities, as we mentioned, with 130 teams to try and handicap. I know you've got a ton of season win total action out there, lots of game of the year action as well. But about a week or so ago, you released some updated power ratings. So you've kind of been looking at the news cycle, injuries, suspensions, practice reports, all these types of things. Now a lot of these teams really hitting it hard with fall camps. So you've been making some adjustments here. So as you make adjustments to your power ratings, what is it specifically that you're looking for? And then how do you go about, you know, making those changes with the teams?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I've probably had more ratings changes in the last 3 days than I've had in the previous, month, just because now pads are being put on and guys are just getting banged up and hurt and whatnot. I guess the adjustments, and I'm not making significant adjustments, but more often than not, I'm looking at cluster injuries at particular positions. Obviously, if they got a key starter that's going to miss the season, I'll do a downgrade there. But and look, I'm not moving teams up and down 3-4 points, but I'm not afraid to make it, a downgrade just because they're not a quarterback. You know, for example, the Iowa Hawkeyes, I mentioned them a little bit earlier, and that's a team that now, at least week one, I haven't downgraded them, or at least my thoughts on the overall season, but when you talk week one, they have both offensive tackles now going to be suspended for that game. They got one of their defensive tackles suspended. Prior this summer, a couple months ago, they lost a starting cornerback and a projected starting safety. So that's a team that I kind of like Iowa when it comes to the overall season, but that's a team that I think is at a major disadvantage now, laying double digits against a very dangerous Northern Illinois team. That's the type of stuff I'm looking for to take advantage of, and just how I've handled my Iowa power rating. I got them down about 1.5 since where I had them probably at the beginning of the summer. They haven't lost a quarterback or one of their best players. It's been non-skill position type players on the offense and defensive lines, but I think they're at a disadvantage, especially against the Northern Illinois defense. That was probably one of the best in the group of five last year.
How about this situation at North Carolina? We touched on this a little bit earlier on in the week with Rolf Michaels, and it was something that he was still kind of digging into a little bit at the time that I asked him. And I'm sure that it was something you reacted to pretty quickly because this is a significant set of suspensions. Now, they're not all going to serve them at the same time because there are some position groups that are hit harder than others. But how big of a downgrade is this situation for North Carolina?
You know, it's significant, but I don't, maybe not as significant as what people think. And I'm going to put a tweet out and that I think it's going to get some play here. What I'll say is what I downgraded North Carolina was only 2.5 points. We're talking 13 players and I only downgraded them 2.5 points. And I think, you know, the market pretty much has done that. Maybe some of the offshore books have downgraded that. I think the line was 6 and it's now 8.5. I agree with that. And that's what I think the appropriate downgrade. I think the public might downgrade them more. Reality is, yeah, Chaz Surratt was made in a quarterback battle. Maybe he was going to be the projected starter, but Nathan Elliott was right there, and Elliott started the last three games last year, and I would argue that was three of North Carolina's better performances at the end of last season. So about a point downgrade at quarterback for me, just because I thought Surratt was more mobile than Elliott. And anytime you lose a guy of that caliber, a little bit of a downgrade there from a depth aspect. I would say another point of the 2.5 point downgrade is probably at the defensive end position where they lost their top three defensive ends. Although, yeah, keep in mind, these suspensions at that position are staggered. So not all three defensive ends are going to be missing the same exact number of games. So keep that in your back pocket. And I downgraded, you know, their offensive line by about 0.5 point. They didn't lose a starter, but they lost four key backups, I think, over the course of four games. And that could hurt them from a depth aspect. So about a 2.5 point downgrade for North Carolina with 13 players. And my tweet is going to put 13 players, North Carolina out, downgrade 2.5 points. If West Virginia's Will Grier goes out, downgrade West Virginia maybe 10 points. So that kind of shows you the value to align on a specific position and don't always be overreacting. When it comes to players, I think more from a depth aspect, that's going to be the biggest hurt. Maybe not necessarily it's going to come into play week one at Cal.
Well, and that's where I was actually going to go next was, you know, you've got Surratt and Elliott who are virtually comparable. You know, I mean, you look at their performances from last year and sure, one guy may have had a little bit more success than the other, but you know, this was largely an open quarterback competition for a while. And you have a lot of those across the country in college football where these guys are just on similar levels. So, you know, is there really that big of a drop-off from one guy to another? No, probably not. But if Will Grier goes out for West Virginia, and we saw how West Virginia's offense looked without Grier last year, you know, that is where the difference really lies. So it's a good lesson to our listeners out there not to overreact when, you know, you see – if you see quarterback in front of somebody's name, you immediately want to think the worst about that team. It's not always the case.
Oh, it's not. And obviously, there's, you know, between big time differences between the NFL and college as far as, you know, downgrading quarterbacks. Because the reality is, I mean, some teams in college just don't have a backup. I guess you could say the same for the NFL as well. But, you know, I mean, you can get differences where a quarterback at North Carolina is only worth a point to the line. You know, and let's talk Alabama. You know, what would be the downgrade? Tua gets hurt going to Jalen Hurts. I mean, it's a downgrade, but. It depends on who you're playing, if Alabama's got to throw the football or not, but that might only be a point or so downgrade where a guy like Will Grier is a touchdown plus maybe even 10 points and whatnot. So it's just completely different situations as far as college goes where, you know, a quarterback can be worth basically nothing all the way up to maybe double digits to a line.
So Iowa and North Carolina are pretty significant examples here of why you would need to tweak power ratings because they've got, you know, some important suspensions at some key positions. And for Iowa, like you mentioned them, two offensive tackles is a big deal. Everyone wants to think about skill position guys, but one of the things that separates, you know, the pros from the Joes, so to speak, is that a lot of times the pros are focused on the trenches and the importance of those particular positions. So offensive tackle suspensions, you know, while they may not move the line too much, we know from a gameplay standpoint that they are very significant. So Iowa, North Carolina, two, you know, outlier examples here. Are there any other teams that you've significantly moved up or down just based on, you know, maybe what's going on with the program, what you're seeing in terms of position battles, anything like that?
You know, not too much. I would say the other team out there that's had a less than ideal summer would be Virginia Tech, where they've had some cluster injuries, particularly in the defensive secondary. And just since late May, this is a team that's lost three projected starters. And we're already kind of an issue on the defense side of the ball where they lost a lot of their best players, including their linebacker Tremaine Edmonds. And then, of course, his brother also went in the first round in Terrell Edmonds. But, you know, Mook Reynolds was a guy that was going to be projected starter. And then they're both their cornerbacks that were projected starters, Jeremy Webb and Adonis Alexander, no longer there. So that's a team that's been downgraded by me, you know, about a point and a half. The market was a little bit slow to react to that news because obviously it's a non-quarterback position there for them. But the cluster injuries for Virginia Tech downgraded them a little bit. You know, generally speaking, not too much. I think Notre Dame's a team you got to keep in mind. It looks like Dexter Williams, it hasn't been officially announced yet, but I fully expect Dexter Williams, who's going to be the projected starting running back, he's going to get suspended probably the first four games of the season. So make sure if you're seeing why Michigan continues to take money in that week one matchup in South Bend, that might be one of the major reasons there. But not too much, but it's coming as far as multiple teams getting adjusted here because, you know, in the last two or three days, I have probably made more circles on my depth chart as far as guys being out for week one or maybe even out for the season than I did in probably the previous 2 months combined.
All right, so let me ask you about this here, Brad, as we transition away from power ratings and adjustments to talk a little bit of home field advantage, because we've been talking about this here throughout the week, and it's something that a couple weeks ago I started diving into, trying to find a formula that worked for me, something I thought made a lot of sense. So when it comes to home field advantage for you, the first question I want to ask is, as you're evaluating these teams, as you're grading out, you know, their recent performances, how far back do you go? Because we know college football, so much turnover, tons of turnover, player turnover, coaching turnover. What's a sample size that you're comfortable with using to determine home field advantage?
Case by case basis. And a lot of times it just, you know, really represents more often than not the head coach, but obviously you get a lot of turnover when it comes to coaching. I mean, 20, 25 guys get hired each and every year. So you got to at least use what the program is. I mean, I dive into depth, you know, just to see, you know, as far as, you know, how often they fill up the stadium because the crowd has just as much of a, you know, play into it as anything. It's probably five or six factors that go into it, how the team does straight up and against the spread, you know, how unique of a place is it, like Wyoming playing 7,000 plus feet of elevation. That is probably worth, in my opinion, an extra half point to the line just because it's unique. And pretty, you know, LSU's a unique case where, you know, LSU's home field advantage is pretty much a net neutral all time. I think they only win 55% of their day games. You flip it tonight in Death Valley and they win about 80% of their games straight up. So it's a case by case basis. Generally speaking, I mean, if you're giving three, you're close. I think I did an average out to my home fields out of the 130 teams. And I think home field is a little bit worth more in college. I know some will disagree. I think on average, I'm about 3.5 points. And why is it, you know, an extra half point or maybe even 0.75 points compared to the NFL? I mean, we're dealing with 18, 19-year-olds. A lot of times it'll be the first time they're getting on a plane in their lifetime. And not always, you know, outside of the teams like Alabama and Ohio State, these kids don't always react well to hostile environments. So, you know, generally speaking, I think on average I'm about 3.5 points to home field advantage.
It's such an interesting discussion for a lot of different reasons, and I agree that there needs to be a variability factor to the home field advantage number that you're slapping on these things, and that's one of the reasons why I was kind of upset with myself that I was just sort of arbitrarily throwing some numbers out there that seemed to me like they made sense. You know, I wouldn't go any lower than three on a team just because, as you mentioned, we're talking about 18, 19, 20-year-old kids having to travel. You know, they've got all kinds of – they're trying to learn how to become adults, too, and take care of their business at home, then take care of their business on the road. Not a real easy thing to do, but there are some places that just don't have the crowd support. Some teams that just don't win at home, don't play well at home. They don't deserve the three. So I felt like I needed to start digging in a little bit deeper and finding some different ways to look at it. And, you know, some kids maybe don't handle time changes well. Some kids maybe don't handle, you know, altitude well, as you mentioned, or maybe – you know, the cold weather team going to play in the hot, humid environment in week one, like we've seen in the past. So, you know, there's so many different factors to try and take into account it that it almost feels like sometimes you don't want to have a generic number for a team. You just want to have one for that particular week.
Yeah, that's a great call there. And I don't have a generic number. So while I was throwing 3.5 as the average, I mean, you mentioned, you know, less than three. I probably have probably 20 teams or so that are probably less than three. And you get it. I mean, when you only got 10 or 15,000 fans in the stands and you just traditionally you don't play well at home, I can't give you a normal three. And more often than not, the market's not giving them a full 3 points. But and then on the flip side of that, you're talking about, you know, maybe Penn State in a whiteout at night. I mean, that's not worth three. We're talking that's more like a 5 point advantage. And, you know, on the flip side of things, I probably have 10 teams or so that I do give that 4.5, 5 points a home field advantage to the line. But generally speaking, you know, out of the 130 teams, I would say 90 to 100 of them are in that 3 to 4 point range. But if you're just slapping, you know, a regular number for every team, that's going to cost you in some cases a point or a point and a half. So be very careful just putting out a generic number. I get it. People work, you know, their normal jobs. Maybe they're just doing this as a hobby. They don't have time to dive in each and every team. But if you want to, you know, if you want to be all right, you know, and maybe pick yourself up. I used to work for this guy. You know, Phil Steele's College Football Magazine, I mean, he staggers his home field edges for all 130 teams. If you wanted to use his numbers, I think, you know, that's a pretty good starting basis as far as if you just want to get some home field advantage numbers.
All right, let's talk some SEC here for a little bit, and let's go to the Alabama Crimson Tide. So another new offensive coordinator. They lose 7 of their top 9 tacklers. They don't have Calvin Ridley. They have something of a quarterback, not controversy, but a competition, although it doesn't seem like Jalen Hurts really has much of a chance in that competition. Does any of this matter for Alabama? Do any of their problems or alleged problems coming into the season matter? They're still number one in your power ratings by a decent amount, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're still number one. Does it matter for, you know, what's going to happen to them at the end of the season? No, they're going to be in the college football playoff as far as I'm concerned. Does it matter if they can be covering point spreads? I think it does, particularly early when you're talking about Alabama has to replace all 4 starters in the secondary, and they lost their top 2 reserves. So top 6 players from the secondary gone. And when you're facing, you know, passing attacks, Louisville, yes, I know they lost Lamar Jackson, but I'm telling you right now, Juwan Pass has the possibility of being a better thrower than Lamar Jackson. And that wide receiver core for Louisville is pretty strong. Well, when you're talking about Alabama laying 25 or more, you know, when you can't defend the pass and you're susceptible to possibly giving up a backdoor touchdown or two. You know, that's my concern there. And it goes along with Arkansas State and Mississippi, two also similar style quarterbacks that are mobile, but they're pass first. So, yeah, I think it comes into play as far as Alabama covering some inflated spreads. That does it matter to me? You know, as far as the overall big picture, no. I mean, Alabama's going to be favored by more than a touchdown in every game this year. And I'll actually – you know, looking at their schedule, I think it's one of the more favorable schedules they've had under Nick Saban. And I know they routinely slip up somewhere. I just don't see where it's at this year. So it's not like they got to go to Auburn. LSU could be a struggle, but we'll see what LSU's all about. That could turn into a toxic situation with Ed Orgeron. Big picture, no. I mean, they're right there at the top, Alabama. Even though they lost 12 players to the draft, they still have the best coach in the history of college football. And they still got a ton of 5-star recruits on the roster. So, yeah, I think anyone out there doing a power rating, if you don't have Alabama 1 or 2, you're making a mistake.
All right, let's talk about the Auburn Tigers here, because I think this is a very difficult team to try and get a handle on for the upcoming season. I have them 8th in my power ratings right now. I will be making some adjustments to those, as I mentioned here throughout the week on the show. When you look at this Auburn team last year, they went 10-4, only 5-7-2 against the number. The 4 teams they lost to were Clemson, not a big surprise, that happens, at LSU, again, LSU still a tough place to play, Georgia, and then Central Florida. So they did get that win over Alabama in the Iron Bowl, but 4 of the 5 best teams they played, they lost. They blew out a bunch of teams in between. So how do you evaluate Auburn coming into this season?
You know, I'm not a huge fan of Gus Malzahn, and kudos to him and his agent for getting him $40-plus million as far as a new deal. But you mentioned it. I mean, they lost a lot of the good teams in their schedule, although, you know, I'd put the question out there. I mean, I have Auburn in the top 10 of my preseason power rankings. I got them, yeah, exactly, number 8, just like you do. And I throw that out there. How many teams are capable? You just go back to the end of last season. I know both games are at home, but how many teams in the country are capable of beating Georgia 40-17 and beating the Crimson Tide by double digits? You can't find more than 10. You got a returning starter at quarterback in Jarrett Stidham that I think will have a better year. Now that he's got more experience in the system, I still think they have one of the better defensive lines in the country with 3 starters back on that side. You know, they do lose Kerryon Johnson at running back, and a lot of people are going to, you know, make a big deal about that. But that running back position in Gus Malzahn's offense has been pretty much plug and play. I mean, there's some question marks, and, you know, this year's schedule is extremely difficult, starting with the game against Washington in the opener where Auburn's a 3-point favorite. I mean, that just tells you the market right now says Auburn's a 3-point favorite over the clear cut, I would say, you know, favorite in the Pac-12 at Washington, who I think is a clear cut top 10 team as far as a preseason power rating goes. So they deserve to be in the top 10 for Auburn. Are they high variance? You know, maybe, but I just don't see it as far as this year. The season win total is right around 9. That's what I have. I mean, they're at Georgia, at Alabama. Both teams want revenge there. Washington's going to be tough. At Mississippi State, it can be very difficult. I think it's a 9-3 type of team, pretty much right in line where they've kind of been here under Gus Malzahn the first 5 years or so of his career.
Yeah, it's pretty funny because I did the Auburn season win total over at Bang the Book, and my expected wins number fell exactly on 9.00. So it was right there with the market expectation. That's even with having them a little bit lower in that game against Washington there in the opener, because I think Washington is a very, very strong team. Now, of course, that could be relative to the rest of the teams in the Pac-12. I may be overvaluing them a little bit here. But, you know, Auburn, it's amazing because they are one of those teams that, as you mentioned, they blew out Georgia. They beat Alabama by double digits. Those two teams played for the national championship. So we know Auburn has a high ceiling. The thing is, you know, when does their floor show up, and in how many games does that actually happen? I think they are a really tough team to figure out going forward. So what do you do with a team like that entering the season? Do you just kind of stay away? Do you wait and see? Are you ready to pull the trigger and adjust quickly? What do you do in that situation?
You know, as far as my power rating, I agree. I think it's a little bit lower. These are reflecting the week 1 game against Washington. I'm a little bit lower than the market. But, you know, a lot of my other games are pretty much in line. I don't expect a significant adjustment on Auburn. I think 9-3 is about the expectation for them. Now, if they go out and beat Washington by double digits, then, you know, I wouldn't be afraid that this team's going to be, you know, in the top 5 of my power rankings come week 2. But there's always kind of a concern in the back of my mind. As good as they'll look, you know, they'll have a game against LSU where they're a touchdown favorite and lose the game outright. Or, yeah, maybe they weren't that motivated against UCF losing outright as a 10-point favorite. And there's always going to be those things in the back of my mind when it comes to Auburn. They just haven't been very consistent under Gus Malzahn. Very good home team under him on the road, and they've been less than ideal.
All right, so let's go to another team here in the SEC West, and we'll talk SEC East for just a couple of minutes. I want to make sure I don't keep you too long here with this first segment of ours. Mississippi State. You had Mississippi State in the power ratings you updated on July 31st as the 15th highest power rated team in the country. They've got Nick Fitzgerald back, and hopefully he comes back from that ugly injury as the same player that he was. They make the hire of Joe Moorhead, who really transformed that Penn State offense. Mississippi State is an interesting one to me because at first glance, I thought to myself, okay, Brad might be a little bit high on this team, but as I'm processing this some more, I'm also thinking to myself, Brad's also one of the sharpest college football minds I've ever encountered. So definitely going to respect that opinion. What is it about Mississippi State that you like so much?
Yeah, and you're exactly right. If I had to identify a team, I'm probably higher in the ratings than any other team as far as the Power 5 goes. It's probably Mississippi State than the rest of the market. I mean, you mentioned it. It starts at quarterback. If Nick Fitzgerald's healthy, you got, in my opinion, a clear-cut top 10 quarterback in the country, if not better than that. 17 returning starters. I like Joe Moorhead. You know, I like Dan Mullen as well, but there's a possibility, believe it or not, Joe Moorhead could be as equal as Dan Mullen. And I think Joe Moorhead's offense, particularly in year 1, could give a lot of these SEC defenses some fits as long as Nick Fitzgerald's healthy. You know, I just go back to it. Last year's team won 9 games, should have won 10. I mean, if Fitzgerald doesn't get hurt against Ole Miss, That's a team that's a 10-win team. And, you know, I go back to the bowl game. That's a team that played without their head coach, without their offensive coordinator, without their defensive coordinator, without their quarterback, and still took it to, you know, a pretty talented Louisville team in the bowl game with an outright upset. How many teams in the country were capable of that? How many teams could have Alabama on the ropes like Mississippi State did in the month of November last year, where they led that game in the fourth quarter? I mean, of course, they had their two slip-ups early in the season, both, you know, on the road at Georgia and also at Auburn, where they got blown out in both games. But outside of that, it was a very consistent team. And, boy, one of the more experienced teams in the country coming back. And I don't necessarily downgrade the coaching staff too much there. I think this is a very dangerous team. And we'll find out really what they're all about come week two when they play at another dangerous team in Kansas State.
All right, let's go over the East here for a couple of minutes. Let's talk to Georgia Bulldogs, because this is one of those scenarios that you run into, especially in the SEC or with these really top-end programs, to where these losses are enormous for Georgia this year. You lose Roquan Smith and Lorenzo Carter on the defensive side. You lose Nick Chubb and Sony Michel on the offensive side, along with your leading receiver, Javon Wims, who was kind of that senior leader that really helped out the young quarterback room there, and especially Jake Fromm. So you've got a third-year head coach in Kirby Smart. You've got a talent pipeline into Athens that is very, very rich in potential. But you've got four or five really, really enormous losses for this team at the skill positions on both sides of the ball. So how do you rate a team like Georgia?
Yeah, I'm downgrading them. I think compared, you know, right now this year's team compared to last year's team is probably 3 or 4 points less because of those losses. I mean, he lost more than 8,000 career rushing yards just between Nick Chubb and Sony Michel. I mean, the number two and three all-time rushers in the history of the program behind Herschel Walker. Roquan Smith arguably was maybe the best defensive player in college football last year, along with you know, Bradley Chubb for NC State. So significant losses, although I'll say this, if you follow recruiting rankings last 2 years, I mean, George, you can make case Georgia's out-recruited everyone, and they got – right now, the number one class coming in for next year already. Kirby Smart, this isn't going to be no one-year wonder with Georgia. Even though I got them downgraded compared to last year's team, plugging that in, I still think you got a top four team in the country. In fact, they're still number four in my power ratings. You look at the schedule, I think they got some tricky games at South Carolina and Missouri, where I might be on the other side as far as a point spread. But the reality is Georgia's going to be favored in both of those games. In fact, Georgia's laying 10 points at LSU. Now, I lean with LSU getting the 10 there, but that tells you how strong the market right now, you know, thinks of Georgia. And for the most part, I agree. They're going to be favored in all 12 games this year, and I'll be stunned, and maybe not if they go 12-0, but I'll be stunned if Georgia's not playing Alabama in Atlanta. I just think, you know, from a point spread aspect, Georgia and the SEC East on a neutral field is 12 or 13 points better than any other team in the SEC East. And even though they lost a lot, they're still head and shoulders above everybody else on that side of the division.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, was is there hope for anybody else in the East to come up and win this thing? And obviously it sounds like probably not, but who would be the team that's the closest? I mean, is it Florida? Is it South Carolina? Does Missouri actually figure out how to stop somebody at some point this year? You know, how do things go for Jeremy Pruitt in his first year at Tennessee? Can anybody make a run at Georgia in that division?
If you'd asked me 2 months ago, I'd have said Florida, because I was high on Florida big time. But, you know, with everything that's going on off the field yet again in Gainesville, you know, and first year for Dan Mullen, who I'm high on, and I think Florida's still one of the most improved teams in the country, I would have said Florida just because, you know, they get Missouri, South Carolina at home and whatnot. But now I'm kind of leaning more towards South Carolina, particularly because I like South Carolina plus the points in that game against Georgia where they get them at home week two. I mean, South Carolina avoids Alabama from the West, avoids Auburn from the West, the two best teams in my opinion, does not play Mississippi State from the West, so they avoid the top three teams in my opinion. Hell, no LSU, the top four teams, host Texas A&M. I mean, the only issue is they're at Florida. That's a little bit of a disadvantage there. But who knows what Florida will be at that point. Now, I'm leaning – it was originally Florida. Now I'm leaning more towards the Gamecocks as far as a team that can maybe make a shocking you know, run to Atlanta. And if that's the case, then I think you can get South Carolina to win the SEC at 30-1, and you can obviously do some hedging if that's the case, and if they actually make it to Atlanta.
Lots of excellent thoughts, as always, from Brad Powers here on this Thursday edition of Bang the Book Radio. His website, bradpowerssports.com. What's going on over there right now, man?
Yeah, right now, I mean, you can download. We talk a lot of preseason at the start of this segment. And, you know, if you want a lot of that preseason information, you can download that for free. My latest newsletter that I just released last week, it's the preseason newsletter. It's up there for free. In fact, you can download all past issues for free up there if you want to get that jump start to the football season, season win totals in college, NFL, game of the year bets, week one, early bets. Get it all for free. And then if you like what you see, why in the heck not sign up for the rest of the season? It's $79 per newsletter. You get my weekly picks, weekly game write-ups on every single college and NFL game, 55% winners, 3+ seasons in that newsletter. We're talking a 500+ game sample size, 55%. That's number one in the country. $79, bradpowersports.com.
And you can follow Brad on Twitter at Brad Powers and the number 7. Brad, appreciate it, man. Great to get you back on the program here. Thank you so much for joining me. We're going to do this every Thursday with Brad, and we'll talk to you again next week, man.
All right. Take care, my friend.
Terrific stuff, as always, from Brad Powers of bradpowersports.com. Again, that Powers Picks newsletter, tons of stuff, write-ups on every game. It is a remarkable piece of virtual paper for you, and definitely something that I would recommend. It's something that even I subscribe to. So, you know, I would certainly recommend taking a look at that and getting some very, very good insights every week on both the NFL and the college football cards. All right, I'm going to chat a little bit of Major League Baseball here today and do an abbreviated version of the Bettor's Box to wrap up today's show. Yeah, because baseball is still going on, still some money-making opportunities out there. And you can find my picks and tips piece every day over at bangthebook.com. Don't love today's card at all. Took it on the chin a little bit with yesterday's card, especially laying that big price with Clayton Kershaw in the Dodgers game. But every day my picks and tips piece still over there. And, you know, I still like these next 3 weeks or so of the baseball season. Once we get into September, it's very hard. Lots of call-ups. We talked about that with Brian Leonard yesterday, where these call-ups can come up and, you know, have some immediate success, kind of shoot some life and some excitement into the ball club. But at the same time, one of the things I really keep a close eye on is the workload of young pitchers, because young pitchers that start reaching new innings thresholds, the stuff declines a little bit in sharpness. Maybe you get some of those injuries that pop up, some of those soft tissue things like that. So I look a lot at pitcher workloads as we get into the month of September and try to figure out, you know, where some of these teams are going to scale these guys back a little bit, you know, where they may be shutting some of these guys down. You know, a lot of considerations in the month of September. For right now, you know, we're still just kind of handicapping baseball as it is and for what it's worth. And, you know, as we look around Major League Baseball right now, when you look at the contenders, the teams that are currently leading the divisions, the teams that are chasing down the wild card spots, a lot of mediocrity right now. You've got a Boston team that's 1-9-10, 15-20, 25-30. They're basically the outlier right now. Houston 11-9 over its last 20. The Cubs 10-10 over their last 20. Phillies 11-9. Indians 12-8 as they've gotten back into the Central Division. You know, that's always good for them. Arizona at 11-9. The Dodgers 11-9. The Rockies 11-9 over their last 20, but they've dropped 7 of 10 here as they've kind of fallen off the pace a little bit. Right now, the only teams really playing at a high level are Boston and Oakland. You know, the Rockies had that good run heading towards the All-Star break, but they have leveled off significantly. The Pirates were also a team that played very well going into the All-Star break, and they're just 5-5 over their last 10. So maybe this is the dog days of summer. Maybe this is a little bit of the doldrums, so to speak, for some of these teams. And that is something you want to keep in mind here, is that, you know, a lot of these teams maybe gearing up for a run over the last 6 weeks of the season, maybe just, you know, everybody kind of sort of knows what they are at this point. And maybe there's not a whole lot of urgency for a lot of these teams. Obviously, there was urgency for Oakland, who had to go on this remarkable run to erase a huge deficit in the wild card chase. And look, let's be honest, they're not that far back from Houston right now, only 5 games behind the Astros in the American League West division. And Seattle's regression has hit. So the Mariners now 3 games back of Oakland. And again, I talked about this on Monday with regards to the Boston series against the Yankees, where, you know, you're your goals, your visions for the rest of the season do kind of change based on everything that's going on. For Boston right now, it's just about maintaining home field advantage. They're up 8 games on Houston. They're up, 15 or so on anybody in the National League. So if they made it all the way to the World Series, they would have home field advantage right now. And that's the goal for them. So what does that mean? What do you have to do in order to maintain home field advantage? Well, they don't have to play at a 70% clip the rest of the way. So maybe they do kind of relax a little bit, take that foot off the gas some. But, of course, they've won 6 in a row, so they're not really showing any signs of doing that. But I think right now, and I continue to handicap from a sabermetric standpoint, and I did that in yesterday's card, but there were a couple of things that maybe I didn't consider from a more intangible standpoint, some of that gray area that is uncomfortable for me when it comes to Major League Baseball, because I am somebody who likes to use the data, likes to use the numbers, and the predictive value that it provides. The Detroit Tigers are an example. The Detroit Tigers were taking on the Angels yesterday. Jaime Barria on the mound for the Angels. The Angels are a fade team to me here in the second half. I don't like anything about the Angels. They've fallen 7.5 behind Seattle. They're 10.5 behind Oakland already, 15.5 out in the division. This is a team with no playoff aspirations. They traded Ian Kinsler. They lost Zach Cozart for the year. Shohei Ohtani can't pitch. Garrett Richards is hurt again. And they've got some guys in Andrew Heaney and Tyler Skaggs who are both recent Tommy John guys who, are pitching a full season for the first time in a while. So the Angels are a big-time fade team to me. Then you look at Barria, who's got that lower ERA, higher xFIP scenario, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, maybe this is a spot where Barria's regression does show up. I thought it was going to show up against the Indians the other night. They scored 3 runs early and then kind of didn't do anything the rest of the way. But what happened was I got tunnel vision with that game. I blinded myself to the problems that the Detroit Tigers are having, who, by the way, since the All-Star break, are far and away, and it's not even close. Take my word for it. They are far and away the worst offensive team in Major League Baseball since the All-Star break. And again, it's not close. They're about 60% below league average, I think, when I looked this morning, since the All-Star break. So they have been awful. And when you're looking for regression to come from a pitcher, the thing is, you need the offense to help out as well. You need the Detroit Tigers in that situation to help out. And I didn't take the time to look at just how bad the Tigers have been offensively here of late. This is a team that's now 21 games under 500. They've been absolutely atrocious in the second half. They've dropped 20 of their last 30. They're just not playing good baseball right now. And not only that, they're getting blown out in a lot of games too. So not just the fact that their offense has been terrible, but also that was a day game, a getaway day game after a long road trip on the West Coast when they've not been playing well. So that was a mistake that I made. And I've been handicapping baseball for a long time. I've been breaking down this game from a sabermetric standpoint for over a decade now. And yet I still missed something. And it's one of those humbling things that you have to come to terms with as a handicapper, where no matter how long you've done this, there are going to be times where you do maybe get tunnel vision, where you do maybe get a little bit careless with something, and then wind up losing money as a result of it. And that was one of those things for me with the Tigers, where, Blaine Hardy's having a decent season, fly ball pitcher at Angel Stadium. Thought, okay, maybe this is a decent spot for him. Oh, look, Barria, here's this regression candidate. Didn't look at how bad the Tigers' offense has been. Considered, but didn't, fully utilize the fact that the Tigers were playing this getaway day game. I thought, this pitching matchup fits for them. Instead of looking at the total package and saying, well, this pitching matchup may work for them, but nothing else really does. Those are the important things that you still have to try and keep in mind from a baseball standpoint. And something where, as I'm looking at the overall landscape of the league right now, with so many of these teams, particularly the National League teams, hovering around 500 over the last 10, 20 games, there's more of a situational element to it at this time of year than I originally believed, I think. And I kind of look at it from a similar spot of this Atlanta Braves-Washington Nationals series. And I did suggest a play on the Braves here. So for anybody that's listening live or catches this right away before that early game kicks off at 1:05, I suggest the Atlanta Braves today. And when you look at what's going on with the respective situations for the Braves and the Nationals, I think that loss in game 2 of the doubleheader on Monday night for Washington was about the worst possible thing for them. Because, or I think it was Tuesday night, actually. Because that was one of those things where They had the opportunity. They had the chance to sweep a doubleheader and make up two games right there in one fell swoop, and they didn't do it. You win the early game. You win the early game with Jeffrey Rodriguez, who's not a very good pitcher. You score 8 runs in that one. You put it in cruise control. You've got yourself set up for the night game to where you say, okay, we've got Max Scherzer on the mound. We've got our ace on the mound. Let's go out there and win this damn game. Let's go out there and start this move to division. What happens? Well, Sean Newcomb, who, you know, I talked about this going into the All-Star break. I think he was a kid who just got tired. I think he was a kid who needed a blow. He's pitched very well since the All-Star break. He holds this Nationals offense to 1 run on 5 hits. And you get that gem you want from Max Scherzer. You get those 7 terrific innings from Max Scherzer. 14 swinging strikes, 6 strikeouts, pounded the strike zone, 83 of 113 for strikes, and you lost that game. And that's the theme of the season for the Washington Nationals here. They get these big spots. You get this spot with your ace on the mound, and you score 1 run. And that's been it. That's been the thing for the Nationals here this season, is that offensively, it's been a letdown. They have all the talent in the world with this offense, but it just hasn't been consistent. These guys just haven't piggybacked each other with quality plate appearances, or, you know, have done enough to set themselves up for success. So then as I look at Wednesday's game, again, another angle where I should have been all over this one. I saw it. I talked about it. I wrote about it. I understood it. But I cost myself a winner by not trusting myself with that handicap, by thinking to myself, okay, maybe this Washington team can figure this out. Because up until this Atlanta series, they were playing well. But they were playing well against Miami and the Mets and the Reds, 3 of the worst teams in the National League. Now they're taking on a good team. They've been, you know, a substandard team against teams with winning records here this year. Washington just 27-36 against teams with a winning record during the 2018 season. Atlanta obviously has one of those. So, again, situationally, you know, I broke down the game, looked at Foltynewicz and Malone, looked at the two lineups, all that type of stuff, and the situational angle didn't carry enough weight in my mind. So that's what you really want to look at, really want to focus and hone in on here as we continue to move forward. When you look at the Washington Nationals specifically, you know, I think they're in a tough spot here today. I do like Atlanta in that game. We'll see if it winds up coming to fruition. But the next 7 games for Washington, the Cubs, who are a very good team, even though they've, you know, kind of been bobbing and weaving throughout the course of the season. And then St. Louis, a team that's actually playing some pretty good baseball since Mike Matheny was let go, a team that wants to get back into that wild card chase, a team that's won 12 of 20, 7 of its last 10. You know, they're playing pretty decent baseball right now. So for Washington here, it's hard for me to get it through my thick head that maybe this thing just doesn't come together. Because when you look at the talent in that lineup, it should. There's no excuse for a team that talented to play the way that the Washington Nationals have. But maybe it's just one of those years. Maybe that just is the case. Maybe it's a lack of leadership. Maybe it's just a lack of they're just missing that panache. They're just missing whatever it is that they need to be a good team here this season. And those are the things that I need to start focusing on. I know the numbers are out there. The odds makers know the numbers are out there too. The influential bettors that move the betting market know that the numbers are out there too. And it seems like situationally, there are more opportunities right now than we've seen in the past. Or in the past, meaning earlier this season. So that is something I think that I need to maybe focus and hone in on a little bit more here. And obviously, I would suggest this to the listeners as well, where I can break down the game. I can look at the predictive elements. I can look at the exit velocity metrics as I've done throughout the season here. But what I generally don't do as much of is look at the situational handicapping, the gray area, the intangibles of a particular game. Now, with what we see from the top contenders around the league, and really what we see from a lot of teams, even the teams that aren't very good, even the teams that are 10 or so games under 500 right now, they're still playing at a, you know, 500, you know, 45 to 55% clip over the last 10, 20, 30 games. So it's just one of those things where nobody wants to stand out right now. So maybe the situational elements are what need to stand out. So that is one of the adjustments that I'll be looking to make here from a Major League Baseball standpoint. And you know, we will start to get some more people into the baseball betting market, because now that NFL preseason's back, now that college football's coming up, people are refilling their bankrolls, or maybe they're, you know, checking that forgot password link to get back into the accounts that they have. And once you get that itch, once you start playing some preseason or some props or some win totals or something like that, you're going to sit there and go, well, this money is burning a hole in my pocket. I got to bet something. Let's bet baseball. So if you are somebody who's going to fall into that mold here a little bit, it's tough because we're 115 games into the season already, and you're certainly playing catch up with a lot of these teams. But you can look at some of those situational elements, get a feel for what these teams have done, start to take a little bit deeper of a look and say, you know, okay, I don't think that this team is really in the right mental state to go out here and win this game. Even if they're a favorite, even if they're in a spot where they should win the game. You know, it's pretty interesting because I look at the Cleveland Indians specifically here, and I was at last night's game and, you know, saw the Lindor walk-off home run, and, you know, they're up 10 games now on the Minnesota Twins. And getting this sentiment, and in fact, I saw an archaic and outdated beat writer throw out a headline in the Cleveland media here today of, you know, well, does this spark the sense of urgency that the Indians need? The Indians don't need a sense of urgency. They're not running Houston. They're 9 games behind Houston for home field. They're not running the Astros down. They're 18 or 17 games behind Boston for the top spot in the American League. They're not running Boston down either. What sense of urgency do the Indians need to play with? Do you want to be playing well as you head into the playoffs? Yeah, absolutely. Well, you can do that because you're playing the AL Central in September. So you can go ahead and put it in cruise control, beat up on those teams as you've done all year long, and then coast into the playoffs and say, okay, now the season begins. What sense of urgency? You know, if the Indians are laying big numbers, and they do oftentimes because they've got such a good starting rotation, what is their incentive? What is their driving force right now to play any better than they've played throughout the year? You know, they're at a 56% winning percentage this year. If they keep that up the rest of the way, they win this division by probably 16 or 17 games. They have this thing locked up easily in mid-September. Why do they need to do anything differently? Why would we expect them to do anything differently? Yeah, last year they went on the 22-game win streak about this time, and that was awesome, and it was great, and it was really cool and everything else. But it also burned them out. You won't hear them talk about it publicly. I will tell you that when you're pursuing a winning streak like that, that ultimately it's a great achievement. It's a bar trivia fact. It's really, really cool. You need to win a damn flag. You need to win a damn trophy. You don't get a trophy for winning 22 games in a row in the regular season. They got home field, which they probably shouldn't have gotten because then they would have played Boston instead of New York. But they got home field, wind up losing to the Yankees. They're going to do things differently here this year. They're not going to run Jose Ramirez and Francisco Lindor into the ground. Now, of course, the unfortunate thing is both of those guys having MVP-type seasons, J-Ram specifically, so they'll keep sending him out there to pad his numbers and all that. But from a pitching standpoint, you know, they're winning 22 in a row. They're pushing Corey Kluber for that Cy Young. It was a detriment to them. It was a detriment to Corey Kluber, who did not pitch well in either one of his division series starts against the Yankees. So this sense of urgency thing for the Indians, it's bullshit. It's not going to happen. Will they go on a run? Maybe. They could, because they're a talented team that has underachieved. But it won't be because they suddenly flip a switch and say, all right, well, let's run down the Astros for a second spot in the division series so we don't have to start on the road. Doesn't matter. They're built for the playoffs. They hit a lot of home runs, and they've got a lot of bullpen depth now with the transactions that they've made. They are built exclusively and specifically for the playoffs. So what do these last, you know, was it 39 games or whatever, 49 games matter to them in the regular season? They don't. And they're going to be priced like they do. Not to say I would fade the Indians with regularity or anything like that, but, you know, we had a question on Monday in the Monday mailbag about parlaying big money line favorites. The Indians are a team that I just wouldn't trust a whole lot in that situation, excuse me, unless they're playing the American League Central, because that division is just so horrendous. I mean, I've never seen a division as bad as this one. I mean, you've got three teams that could very well finish the season with winning percentages below 40%, which is really hard to do. But the Central Division's working on it. So that's the thing. You know, when you're the Houston Astros, right, you're probably not going to run down Boston. Now, you could. You're probably not going to. When you play Oakland and Seattle, are you going to show up? Hell yeah, you are. You're going to make that statement. You're going to put that division away. I think that's something where you could look for Houston to do that here this weekend against the Seattle Mariners, where they just kind of put Seattle out of its misery, shove them down the standings a little bit, kind of kickstart that regression that's been coming for them, that I guess not kickstart it, but continue that regression that's been coming for them. When they face Oakland, you know, you swat that team down. You basically do what the Cavaliers did for so long in the NBA of, oh, hey, we've got this challenger. No, we don't. And then they just kind of bat them away. You know, it's sort of the old thing where if you've got somebody who's shorter than you and you just kind of hold them by the forehead and they wildly swing trying to hit you, that's kind of what I feel like Houston's going to do to Oakland and Seattle here the rest of the way when they play those two teams. But when they play other teams, will they have that sense of urgency? Will they have that sense of purpose? Probably not. You know, does Houston care if they win 100 games? I don't know. They're going to win the division. They're not going to win home field. Is getting that round number a big deal? Could be. Maybe. I don't think it is. So you have to look at the different motivations, the different mindsets of these teams based on who they're playing, when they're playing them, and really just the total package. You know, and it's hard for me to say this because, like I've said already, I'm a sabermetrics guy. I'm a predictive metrics guy. I like the value that breaking down the numbers can provide. But you have to be a little bit more versatile these days because a lot of people use the numbers. A lot of people understand them. And you know, the books know line moves are coming in certain situations. They're willing to embrace them, but they know that they're coming. So we have to find our edges in different types of ways. Even if it's a little bit uncomfortable, even if it's something that's out of your comfort zone, something that maybe isn't quantifiable, like there's still value in it and maybe more predictive value than I've originally believed. Now, of course, when we look at the National League, I know I focus a lot on the American League here, so we'll look to the National League. You've got interchangeable teams at the top of all three divisions. The Phillies are up a half game on the Braves. The Braves are playing very well right now. The Cubs are up a game and a half on the Brewers. The Brewers have sagged off a little bit, but the Cubs are still a team that I think they are one of those teams that can flip the switch and do things a little bit differently here, especially if they get their pitching problems figured out. And then out west, Arizona's still holding off the Dodgers by a half game. The Dodgers are the best team in that division. I don't think anyone would dispute that fact. When you've got a healthy Clayton Kershaw and Rich Hill, when you add Manny Machado and Brian Dozier, and I talked about this last week when I was recapping the trade deadline, the Dodgers had the worst offensive performance at second base of any team in baseball. Now they've got Brian Dozier. Now they won't have the worst performance of any team at second base. They've filled the needs that they have. But yet still, they're a half game behind Arizona, can't seem to get over that hump, can't seem to put any distance in there. Why is that? Well, for one thing, when you're a team that went to the World Series last year, you know what it takes. And you know that it takes really pacing yourself, managing your body, managing your workload to get to that point. So at some point, the Dodgers turn the ignition over, start the car up, blow by the Diamondbacks. But we don't know when that's going to be. It will happen. I think that's certainly going to happen. And I hope it doesn't because I've got Arizona plus 600 to win the division. But it will probably happen. And we have to try to figure out when. When will the Dodgers hit that patch where they say, okay, we're the Los Angeles Dodgers? Because right now, this is a team with all that talent, with all that payroll, with a decent manager in Dave Roberts. They are 12th in winning percentage in Major League Baseball. That's not going to continue. That will not be a sustainable trend for the Dodgers as we go forward. So you look for buy signs on teams like that. You look for buy signs on teams like the Cubs that, you know, have throughout most of the year led all of Major League Baseball in position player F4, just haven't had the pitching to complement it. Well, when do they figure this pitching thing out? Do they? If they don't, it's a problem for the playoffs. If they do, they're going to win this division by probably 5, 6, 7 games over the Brewers or maybe the Cardinals. We'll see how long the Brewers can sustain what they're doing from a starting rotation standpoint. But that's the thing. You have to get a feel for these teams. It's not enough just to look at the metrics right now. And that's what I'm finding out. And that's something that, again, is out of my comfort zone. But the evolution of yourself as a handicapper comes from doing those things, comes from getting out of your comfort zone, evolving, adapting, understanding, adding perspective. That's how you improve in this business. And to circle it back to that conversation with Brad Powers earlier on the show, he's always been a brilliant handicapper. But I know he will tell you, and I know his friends will tell you, that the transition to being a better was a little bit uncomfortable, to going out there and hitting the early numbers, getting the best of the number, understanding where the market's going to move, driving around to shop around for the best prices, All these types of things are part of your evolution as a bettor. It's a different type of feeling. So I can handicap games. I've always been able to handicap games. Betting games is something that even still to this day, for as long as I've been doing this, still gives me fits at times. And some of that intangible, some of that gray area, some of that perspective and evolution comes from the mindset of being a bettor, of understanding that there are things that you have to look deeper into. There are things that you have to consider at certain times more than others. That's part of the betting process. Handicapping is breaking down the matchup. Team A versus Team B, starter C versus starter D, bullpen E versus bullpen F, offense G versus offense H. That's what handicapping a game is. Looking for that next level, looking for that next part of being a bettor, and that's what we're going to help you achieve here, not just on the bettors box, not just on all these segments, not just in all the content that we have at bangthebook.com, but with the total package, with everything that we have to offer here for the football and the basketball seasons. So as far as this weekend goes from a Major League Baseball standpoint, you know, again, you're looking for those types of things. You're looking for those types of spots where you can say definitively one way or another, I like this team in this spot. I think this is a good spot for them. I think this isn't a good spot for them. And as we look at this weekend, we're going to see some big lines that are out there for a lot of these games. But a lot of times the better teams are on the road here this weekend. You've got Boston in Baltimore. You've got Arizona in Cincinnati. You've got Cleveland in Chicago. You've got St. Louis in Kansas City. You've got the Dodgers at Coors Field. You've got Philadelphia at the Padres, Pittsburgh out in San Francisco, Oakland in Los Angeles. So you're going to have a lot of road chalk here this weekend. And that'll be one of those things that you want to make sure that you're taking a next look at, a next level look at, I should say, to see if those are spots where you want to lay some road prices. So it will be an interesting weekend. It will be a challenging weekend for a lot of different reasons across Major League Baseball. So just make sure that you're prepared for it, because you will be laying those road prices, and you'll be looking at home road splits for pitchers. And a lot of times those aren't always the most favorable looking things for the pitchers when they go out on the road. So again, lots of considerations from a Major League Baseball standpoint here at this time of the year, some tangible, some intangible. And I'll try to help you along the way in that picks and tips article throughout the weekend. Coming up on our Friday edition of Bang the Book Radio, Lockie Lockerson will join us, Bang the Book contributor. You can find him on Twitter at Lockie Lockerson. He'll chat with us about the Heisman picture, about teams that actually have a reasonable chance at winning the college football playoff. We're just going to do a lot of just general college football statements that can have a betting impact for you in the futures market, the props market, and then, of course, in the ways that you want to think about these teams for the start of the season. Now, we'll also be joined by Vegas Maddie from footballcontest.com. He's our proxy service for the Super Contest. We'll talk with him about the history and the evolution of the Super Contest, what the Super Contest actually is, about the proxy service that he provides, and then also some forecasts for, you know, what those fields may look like for the traditional Super Contest and the Super Contest Gold. And then we'll also get him to break down the Gold Nugget Ultimate Football Challenge, which is something that we're doing this year for the first time at Bang the Book. And maybe you want to get involved if you're heading out there to sign up for the Super Contest as well. So that'll be the way that we wrap up this week on Bang the Book Radio. So that'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.